Hello and welcome to the Fermat's Podcast Project. My name is David Simmons, and it gives me great pleasure to be in conversation today with Rita Mae Reese. She is the author of The Alphabet Conspiracy and The Book of Holga. It was selected for the Felix Pollack Prize. Rita Mae is the recipient of a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, a Stegner Fellowship in Fiction, and a Discovery of the Nation Award, among many others. She designs lesbian poet trading cards for Headmistress Press and is the director of literary arts at the Arts Plus Literature Laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin. You can find out more about her at ritamayreese.com. Hello and welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I also noticed that you have an MFA in writing from UW-Madison, and that you worked on the Dictionary of American Regional English and spent a lot of time poking around in the online edition of the OED. Those are two of my favorite books.
Yeah, they are terrific, aren't they?
And in reading The Alphabet Conspiracy, I see that many of the poems were, in fact, inspired by words. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. I was definitely in love with the OED and just using it to one word was leading to another and just looking up things and finding, especially the etymology. I just became fascinated by etymology.
Plus, I noticed that many of your poems are prompted by specific historical events.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a few words about that?
Yeah, I grew up in West Virginia, and so a number of them deal with specific events that happened in West Virginia, like mining disasters. And there's a poem in there about Carrie Buck, who was the subject of one of the worst Supreme Court cases that ruled it was okay to sterilize people for mental incompetence. And so I became interested in her and her daughter, Vivian Buck, whom she was pregnant with. So there's a poem in there kind of paying a tribute to this person who's been totally forgotten. Her child, she was separated from her child, still always hoped to be reunited with her, and the girl died when she was only 8 years old.
A sad story.
It's really tragic.
What are some of the other influences on your poetry?
I'm fascinated by Flannery O'Connor, so my second book was about her using one of her characters as a lens. And so reading the things that she wrote has just informed a lot of my writing in general. She was really interested in theology and philosophy and history to some extent, but mostly theology and philosophy.
So we're sitting here in the somewhat chilly space of the Arts Plus Literature Lab, which has become an incredible space for all kinds of art, theater, mm-hmm. music, visual arts, poetry. We did our Mother Courage Alone here at the end of September. But it seems to me that in the last 10 years, there's been this flowering of poets and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just me sort of paying attention in my old age, or is there really a sort of rebirth of people doing poetry?
You mean nationally or Madison?
Locally.
Locally, yeah. I mean, I think it is true, and it reflects a larger national trend. There's been a lot of excitement around the spoken word, mm-hmm. and I think that's really helped re-energize poetry and make us think about new possibilities
okay.
and have different expectations for what the word can do. What I've become really interested in the past 5 years or so is this idea of creating community through art and creating art through community. And, of course, that's one of the staples of theater.
Right.
That is okay, sort of the definition, I think, in some ways. But it's true, too, for the other art forms, especially poetry. It has a different weight and value when it's performed in a public space.
And it's very much the case for theater as well, and especially in a small, intimate space like this, we had a really good vibe
mm-hmm.
With Mother Courage.
Yeah.
But what you've done here is amazing. I mean, there are things going on here just about every week that I want to go to.
And
I either don't have the time or the money to go to the mall, but I did see three great jazz performances this past fall.
Yeah, that's great. Well, money should never be an obstacle because we'll do, you know, most of our events are donation based. Right. So if you can't afford it, we don't want you to miss it.
All right, that's good to know. Okay. Yeah. So what are you going to read for us today?
I thought I would read some poems from my second book, The Book of Hulga, and maybe just give you a little background about the book so that it makes more sense. Flannery O'Connor was a Southern writer. She was one of the sort of architects of Southern Gothic, which is this dark school in literature. She wrote mostly short stories. She did write a couple of novels. They weren't as well received. But one of her most famous short stories is A Good Man is Hard to Find, and that's about a family that tries to go on a road trip, and they meet up with a serial killer called the Misfit, and things don't go well. But she thought the story was really funny. There's an audio that surfaced of her reading it, and she's just cracking herself up. So I first read her when I was in college, and I'd never read anything like her. She has this kind of starkness, but it was also, it felt very Appalachian to me. I know she's writing from the Southern, she was writing from the South, but not really in the Southern tradition, because the Southern tradition is more like a preoccupation with the Civil War, which she only would do mockingly. There's sort of a lot of tropes involved with Southern literature that she just entirely steered clear of. But she was really interested in kind of backwoods prophets and working class people and the way people really talk to each other. And she wasn't interested in glorifying the poor, but she didn't dismiss them as cardboard characters either. So there was this humor and range in her work that I really loved. So I read a lot about her and then discovered that she'd been working on a novel when she died. She died when she was only 38 because she had lupus. So she developed a tumor, and they knew if they operated, it would likely reactivate it, and it did, and she went into a coma and died very young. But she was still working to the last minute. But she reported humorously in her letters that the doctor said she couldn't work, but she could write fiction. She loved that. So she was revising one of her short stories at the very end. So I used to live in Tallahassee. I lived there for 13 years and would take some pilgrimages to Milledgeville, where she'd lived. And I was part of a National Endowment for the Humanities Institute one summer, where I got to be in the archives and really immerse myself in her work. And that's where I discovered more about the novel that she'd been working on. And I went into it kind of hoping that it was salvageable, like it could be one of those things you could publish posthumously, but it was just still all over the place, which for me was kind of comforting as a writer to see that many false starts in such an acclaimed writer's, one of her later works, you know. Right. It was really hopeful. So anyway, I kind of wanted to find a way for those ideas to still make it into the world. And so I looked at what she was doing, and it was sort of an autobiographical novel about a writer who's living at home with his mother. She mostly wrote about men and male characters. And he, instead of working on the novel that he was supposed to be working on, was writing letters to friends. And, you know, she spent a good deal of her time writing letters to friends. She has a wonderful collection of letters called Habit of Being, and they're very funny and charming and filled with a lot of great advice. So anyway, I immersed myself in those letters and came across this line that she'd written to her friend Betty Hester. She said, "If I were to live long enough and develop as an artist to the proper extent, I would like to write a comic novel about a woman. And what is more comical and terrible than the angular, intellectual, proud woman approaching God inch by inch with ground teeth?" And so her friend thought that she meant Simone Weil, who they were talking about, the French philosopher who wanted there to be absolutely no gap between what she believed and what her actions were. So she was a really hard person to be around. Wasn't very popular. She did have a lot of friends, but she was very difficult. And she ended up starving to death because she didn't want to eat more than the soldiers were given as rations during World War II.
So, there's the sort of complex of She was Jewish, but she was a convert to Catholicism. Is that right?
Well, she didn't ever join the church because she was born Jewish, but her family wasn't particularly observant. And she had a mystical experience where she believed she, you know, met Jesus. And occasionally people would try to get her to join the church, but she resisted because she felt like she was too easily influenced by what other people believed and felt. And so that it would separate her from having a truly personal relationship with God, and she would get kind of led astray by the church. And so O'Connor was really fascinated by Vey because O'Connor said that the church is our cross to bear in this life. She didn't think terribly highly of it, but she felt like you really shouldn't and couldn't have a relationship with Jesus without having that be a relationship with God, without that being a relationship in a community.
Okay.
So she felt the church was central, and that if you try to go it alone, it could result in basically heresy. So anyway, reading that led me to looking at the notebooks of Simone Vey, and I hadn't been very familiar with her before that, but I became fascinated. Her notebooks were just beautiful. The writing, she was fiercely intelligent, and the lines were just gorgeous. So I started writing. I wrote down all my favorite, and there were like 380. And I thought, oh, I want to be able to use these somehow. So I came up with the idea of given line poems, and that's where you take a line from something else, and the poem proceeds from that. And then I created crowns of sonnets that began with and ended with the given lines from her notebooks. And that turned into three crowns of sonnets, all interwoven using Simone Vey as the architecture for it. So I might read one of the possible crowns from that sonnet series. The first one's called The Given Lines. There is the nothingness from which we flee and the nothingness toward which we go. Hell is nothing, God is nothing, and we are the nothing lost between. Out of our pain, we make countries, maps, direction. She has made herself into a map of the red forest where an albino swallow circles and drops, where boars and bison and roses have made an almost home, but no human ever comes and none ever will. All of the empty spaces have the outline of someone missing. Her heart, never still, digs its red hole, forcing roots into the absence. Revising history. To be rooted in the absence of a definite place, to belong to mountains that have been removed, to valleys that have been filled, a world gone flat, is to learn geography as affliction. To be rooted as if my spine extends invisibly down into dirt and rock, deeper than drills can go, tethered to some hot core, is to lose part of myself when I leave. Nothing thrives here, and I can't thrive anywhere else. We don't get to choose which part of ourselves we'll lose, or even to know what it is we've lost. We don't get to know where we should go, or how to hold still, or any of the other things Pavlov's dogs and other martyrs must know. The reward. Pavlov's dogs and other martyrs know. After great pain, a bell rings. Their eyes strain to see the vial sutured in the cheek below, catching drool they know is worthless or worse. After being made fluent in Russian pain, they become his and deathless, or close. A bell rings and the heart relents until everything sounds like a bell. The vial fills with faith in master and reward. It is all that can offer the reward that is master. But even this holds a drop of alchemy in its dregs, a lesson in giving, in the spirit of one who begs.
Oh, it was lovely.
Thank you. Displaced. Learn to give in the spirit of one who begs. Outside the grocery store, a man is begging. We are broke, and I have always been poor. Though you have no job, you roll down your window. I won't let you give, and all the way home, we argue. I point out we don't know what he's done or will do. He might have beat his wife, raped someone, who knows? And if we gave, he'd just get drunk. His life hopeless either way. Years later, he's probably dead, and I've lost track of you. Still, I can't give. I just let each one take until she gets tired of taking and leaves. Everywhere, I see the cast on his arm and the black dog at his feet. Stories about miracles confuse everything. This next one is titled There's Wood Enough Within, and that's from The Tempest. It's the first line that Caliban speaks in The Tempest. And I always thought if Hulga or Flannery ever had a chance to perform in a play, they would definitely be Caliban in The Tempest. The stories about miracles confuse everything. You awake to the wolf of Gubbio licking your hand, St. Francis bringing you breakfast in bed. Your room is the lion's den, and you are Daniel. Your room is a whale, and you are Jonah, Pinocchio, Ahab. The windows disappear, the walls lean in. The walls of Jericho may fall, but not these walls. These walls are trees, and you are where someone loves you best of all. Your room is the woods, and you are only a girl, but a whole girl, a girl without pain, standing still at the edge. Then comes a knock like a flame catching the trees, and you, poor wooden girl, caught as pain opens the door. And then there's just a couple more in this series. Let's see. Back to... The margin is for the Holy Ghost. And that line, the title is borrowed from a letter that Betty Hester, O'Connor's friend, wrote to her when she loaned her the notebooks of Simone Weil. Flannery O'Connor loved to write all over books that she was reading, and her friend warned her that the margin needed to be reserved for the Holy Ghost. The pain that opens the door is not God, though you worship it and fear it and pray to it with your loose, odd devotion, your stuttering, cross-eyed faith. Were it only a little taller, a little less full in the hips, it wouldn't stun the nuns to silence, burn the priests to fulminate on redness and virginity, the sun you carry low, the woe you carry high. You are 9/10 the heresies you cherish, 1/10 something saintly, beaten, and sly. On your face, love lies garish. You turn off the lights when you look in the mirror and pray. There's a usage for every kind of error. Everything That Rises. And that title's from one of O'Connor's famous short stories, Everything That Rises Must Converge, which she had gotten the idea from Teilhard de Chardin, who believed in an evolving God. And so his theory of passive diminishments, that the things that we lose along the way bring us closer to God. And she found that very comforting because she knew from the time she was about 25 that she was dying, that she wouldn't live long. Everything That Rises. There's a purpose for every kind of error, and you're still asking what yours will be. It is one of your weaknesses that you believe someone or something can spin you into gold. The black dog at the foot of the bed stirs, digs a hole to bury you. Nothing to do but lie still, taste dirt. Nothing will save you from tragedy except comedy, which is worse. Let the ground find a use for your body, which was my home. Which was never my home. Let the ground find a use for your body, which was my home, which was never my home. Let the words sink beneath your tongue, which was my root. Close your eyes now, and let the nothingness from which you flee be the nothingness.
Oh, why don't you repeat that?
The whole poem?
Yeah.
Just to make it easier. Girls, be careful about not moving the table, because it's pretty loud in here, okay? It's okay. I know it's... Okay. Are you done scooting?
Yeah.
Okay. Everything that rises. There is a purpose for every kind of error, and you're still asking what yours will be. It is one of your weaknesses that you believe someone or something can spin you into gold. The black dog at the foot of the bed stirs, digs a hole to bury you. Nothing to do but lie still, taste dirt. Nothing will save you from tragedy except comedy, which is worse. Let the ground find a use for your body, which was my home, which was never my home. Let your words sink beneath your tongue, which was my root. Close your eyes now and let the nothingness from which you flee be the nothingness.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
Perhaps we should do a podcast of the notebooks of Simone Weil.
That would be great. I would really love that. Hi.
Hello.
How are you? Oh, wow. Look at the snow coming down.
I know. It's starting to really come down now. I was just looking for, I got a photographer coming to take some pictures. I was just looking to see if he was in here.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you.
Sorry. So can you talk about what you're working on now?
I've been working on a novel about a haunted house that's set in West Virginia. And my next poetry project is tentatively titled Self-Portrait as George Washington's Teeth.
He had wooden teeth, didn't he?
Well, that's a myth, actually.
Really?
So,
okay.
Yeah. One of the fabulous things about having kids is you get to read a lot of kids' books. And there was one about George Washington's teeth, which was just fascinating. I had known he had a lot of pain from his teeth when he was crossing the Delaware. I think he only had about 7 teeth left. By the time he was inaugurated as president, he kept his mouth shut because he only had 2 teeth left. And he spent a lot of money on his teeth, and he would save them in little boxes around his house. And eventually he found a dentist who could help him create a set of dentures using those and hip bones from hippos, I think.
Really?
And he wired, he had like these massive hands. He was a big guy, but he did all the delicate wiring of wiring them together himself so that he could once again chew.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and I just read Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders and thinking about how Lincoln had lost his son and what a profound influence that had on him and his humanity, and just thinking about the pain, tooth pain is incredible. It's really hard to think around and through.
Yeah.
And so just thinking about the effect that had on him as a person and a leader, and so the effect that it had on our country. Yeah. And just...
Some of the customs of the 19th century in terms of burial are very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, 1 year after his wife died, reopened her coffin and
really?
Spent some time just looking at her remains.
Wow. Yeah. It's unthinkable today, isn't
it?
It
is.
But it would not have been considered morbid or...
No.
Yeah.
No.
There's a closer relationship with... Yeah. Even when I was growing up, there were still people who believed in, sitting up with the body and those kind of rituals that now, thinking about bringing the body to your house and sitting up with it all night, there's no one who does that. And they think you're crazy. But it's such a, I think it's important to help with the grieving and coming to terms with that loss.
Yes. It needs to be out there, and it needs to be a physical presence, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Rita May, thank you very much. We'll have to do this again.
Yes.
And good luck with your future projects.
Thank you so much. Thanks for talking with me and this podcast. This is a terrific project.
All right, thanks. Oh, I should add that the podcast project is supported in part by grants from the Wisconsin Arts Board, the Madison Arts Commission, and Dane Arts. Thank you very much.